This is Topical Talks by Title Research, the podcast about estate administration, probate, and all other areas in the wills and probate legal sector.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to another episode of Topical Talks by Title Research. My name is Anthony Alsop, and I'm Head of Business Development here at Title Research. Today I'm joined by Simon Barber, who is our resident experienced technical manager, and I'm delighted to announce that we are joined by Jeff Deroon, who is Director of Trust, Probate and Estates Risks at Trust and Probate Insurance. We're going to talk a little bit about insurance in the industry that we work in. It's quite a niche area, and we're lucky to have Jeff in with us, who is an expert. So without further ado, I'm going to hand over to Simon just to start proceedings off.
Lovely. Thank you, Anthony. And thanks for joining us for this today, Jeff. And I mean, you and I and the businesses that we work for have worked together for must be 10 years or more now. But perhaps it could start, if you could just let us know a bit about your background. How did you get into the world of insurance in the first place? And I'm guessing over the years the industry has evolved for you as much as it has for us. So perhaps you could start by telling us a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. So I'm a solicitor by background. I qualified many years ago in the commercial property department of the firm I was with at the time. I then moved in-house with an insurance company providing bespoke insurance solutions. At that time around property transactions. For the last 10 years or so, I've been focusing on developing and delivering bespoke insurance solutions for trust, probate and estate risks. As you say, during that time, we've seen quite a lot of changes, I think, both in terms of clients' demands, what they need, and also in, I think, the insurance industry itself. As you said, it's a real niche area, but the last sort of 6 to 8 years has seen a real increase in the different types of insurance solutions that are available in this area.
I mean, you mentioned property and conveyancing insurance, which is where you perhaps were originally. That's always been perceived as almost a standard issue policy, you almost do it yourself. Whereas a lot of the insurance that we get involved in with you is more, like you said, bespoke. So are there quite some differences between a lot of the standard conveyancing matters that you would underwrite and perhaps the more unusual, more niche probate matters that we refer on to you?
Yeah, there are. It's funny because in you know, in the property world, there are also a whole array of bespoke niche products. But I always think the interest between the two different areas is that property lawyers, conveyancers, commercial property lawyers generally will use insurance more readily than probate and trust lawyers. It's not to say that trust and probate lawyers don't use insurance. I just think it's a bit of a newer concept for trust and probate lawyers. So commercial property lawyers, probate, residential property lawyers have always looked to insurance over the years as a solution to try and help get over a particular risk. And I think going back to what I was saying earlier on about you know, the developments in the industry in the trust and probate world, is that's starting to happen more now with trust lawyers, probate lawyers. If there is a particular issue, I think insurance is more on their agenda now as a go-to, as a possible solution, as a way to keep their client happy and to facilitate the transaction.
Do you think the rising contentious probate has prompted that a little bit? People are a lot more aware, perhaps, of the risks that are involved if something goes wrong. Whereas in the past, you administered your estate, you dealt with it was gone. Now there's much more perception of making claims against estates and things like that. Do you think that's contributed to it?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And that is probably been one of the biggest sort of developments in the area, hasn't it? The rise in the contentious trust and probate cases. You've seen high profile cases like the ILOC case, which has really sort of focus the mind, I think, with people who are doing this day to day. At the end of the day, you know, a lot of this is not contentious, and I think that's the way it's being approached. And if you ever have a concern that maybe there is a potential for it to become contentious or litigious, solicitors, advisors, even clients to some extent are keen to explore the possibility of protection. Mm. And for solicitors as well, a contentious market means that their PI cover is exposed more.
Yeah.
Because whether it would ever be covered under their PI cover, that's probably going to be the starting point for any claim against the solicitor or the estate's professional advisors. So they're more aware of it. And I think, you know, the sorts of solutions that we provide and that are out there now in the market, I think that gives it a market where people will sort of look to that and see, you know, does it exist? Is it for me? Could it work?
So what are the main solutions that you offer to assist any of our clients who are administering estates in whatever capacity that may be?
So, as I say, I think this is a developing area, and it has developed rapidly in the last few years. There are now readily a whole array of insurance policies available for those involved in dealing with the administration of estates. So you can now quite easily obtain cover for the likes of missing beneficiaries, potential missing wills, creditor risks, Inheritance Act claims, I mentioned earlier the ILOT case, issue risks, contingent survivorship risks, and a whole array of trustee indemnity risks generally, just to name but a few. There's also a wide variety of bespoke solutions that can be tailored to a particular set of circumstances depending on the case. All of those cases, or all of those risks that I mentioned earlier, they're fairly, depending obviously on the underlying risk and the circumstances of the case, they're fairly easy to obtain. They're almost, if you like, off-the-shelf type policies. And I think that's probably the biggest change that we've seen in the industry over the last few years.
So, I mean, the main things that we would be referring things to you are the missing beneficiary side of things, and perhaps the missing will indemnity side of things. We feel as if we are obtaining many more of the comfort style policies than perhaps we were in the past. Do you think that's true? And perhaps can you just set out the difference between a comfort policy and a known missing beneficiary policy as well?
Yeah, sure. So generally, let's start at the beginning. The difference between the two. So we call it comfort within the industry, within the insurance, and within the genealogist world. So this is where you're distributing an estate and there is no thought or suggestion of there being any missing beneficiaries or incomplete parts of the family tree. But the proposed insured, which is usually the PR, they want the benefit of an insurance policy just in case there's an unknown member out there who does come forward, or an unknown line that comes forward. So your typical scenario might be where you've got a professional PR, or you may have a lay PR, but the family's particularly diverse and scattered across the globe, and they're not particularly aware of the extent of the family themselves. So they're looking for cover just in case, after they've distributed the funds and they no longer have access to the funds, in case somebody comes forward with a legitimate claim to an entitlement. And that, you know, that claim can vary. It can be somebody who's due a percentage of the estate, or indeed it could be somebody who's a prior class on an intestacy and is actually entitled to the whole lot. So these are the things that will get a well-advised, a well-informed PR thinking about their potential liability and what they can do to help themselves once they've distributed the estate to make sure they no longer have that potential personal liability. The other side of that sort of scenario is where you have a known missing beneficiary. It is what it says. So you might have a particular person named in a will, or you may have a particular person that we know exists who's entitled to an intestacy, or indeed you may have a whole line that is known about that has gone off to another part of the world, and then you just can't, despite your efforts, you just can't trace that line and where it ends up. So Those are same type of risk, but what you're doing there is ensuring a known risk, a known exposure, that that person or those persons come forward and make a claim to part of the funds after you've distributed it.
Excellent.
Does that generally affect the cost of a policy if there's a known risk versus more of a comfort policy?
Yeah, that's a good point, and it does. It affects the premium, which is the cost, and it affects the underlying sort of underwriting of the risk itself, because whilst the underlying risk is the same, they're different in terms of the remoteness of the risk, if you like, because an insurer is going to look at any risk with an eye on how remote is this risk, how likely is it that what we're insuring against is going to happen. So if you've got a comfort case, as we call it, so there is no suggestion of a missing beneficiary, and it's been well researched by a professional probate genealogist like Title Research, and all the members of the family have confirmed that they're not aware of anyone else, then, you know, as an insurer, you can get comfortable about the remoteness of the risk. It seems to stack up, and you can get comfortable. That has an effect in the level of due diligence that you'll do as an insurer, and to answer your question as well, Anthony, it'll affect the premium, the actual cost of it. If you look at the other scenario we had where you have a known missing beneficiary, your underwriting is going to be a bit more forensic, if you like. You're going to be really trying to drill down into this person, these persons, what's known about them, when were they last in contact, what was their lifestyle, do they have a habit of disappearing for 6 years and then reappearing. You know, you're getting down to that sort of level of detail. And then you're assisted by, you know, the genealogist report as well, which will throw up the background to the family and what's known about their last movements. So that's affecting the way you underwrite it. And of course, that's going to affect the cost as well, because the chances are, in terms of the severity of the risk and underlying risk, the missing beneficiary, the known missing beneficiary, is going to be a more severe risk than a comfort cover.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things that comes up from time to time, particularly on the known perhaps beneficiary more than the comfort cover, is the question of the moral hazard, which is a question you've asked us on a number of estates which we've referred to you. Could you perhaps go through that a little bit for us, just to explain what that means in practice and how it affects the premium and the underwriting?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you're looking at a known missing beneficiary, as I said earlier, you're, as an insurer, as an underwriter, you're trying to build the picture, you're trying to understand what we know about this person or these persons, and there is various sort of elements to that jigsaw, if you like, or pieces to that jigsaw. One of them is the probate genealogist report, which will help us. The other thing is you're looking at the family testimony. Now, what you're trying to do is bring all of these factors together and come to the conclusion that this is actually a good risk to write. Family testimony can be really important, depending on what the family know. Obviously, sometimes they know nothing, which obviously doesn't really give you a great deal to go on. But other times, they'll have really crucial pieces of information that helps us as an insurer and that can help you as a probate genealogist. What can sometimes be tricky is if we have members of the family who are entitled in the absence of the missing beneficiary, and that brings in what's termed as the moral hazard, which is effectively, are we relying on family testimony from the very people who stand to benefit in the absence of the missing beneficiary? The moral hazard being, of course, that perhaps it might not be in their interest to tell you everything to find the missing beneficiary, because of course, if the missing beneficiary is found, then they, as the next class of kin, won't actually take their monies. So as insurers, you're aware to these issues, you're looking at the detail of the family testimony, but you're also looking at who it's coming from, what their role is, and, you know, it's not the be all and end all, but it's a factor you're always thinking about. Is there a moral hazard in relying on the family testimony from these particular individuals? Now, when that happens, there are various things you can do. You can obviously look to get family testimony from wider afield within the family. So they may be on a branch or a line that doesn't benefit at all in the absence of the missing beneficiary. So, you know, it's something that underwriters will always be wise to. And a good experienced underwriter working with a good probate genealogist ought to be able to have, they ought to have enough to be able to get around that scenario when it happens.
So we mentioned earlier on about the evolution of the industry over our times in both of our businesses. It's changed, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
One of the things we're finding at Title Research is that the types of family that we are researching is changing. So we're doing a lot more close immediate family, so next of kin being class of spouse or issue, and also much more international work. Has that affected the underwriting that you've had to do and the way that you approach your due diligence in any way?
Yeah, it has, and I think the like you, what we see more and more of now is non-UK elements coming into either the family structure or the ownership of the assets. So it's an area we're always conscious of, because you know we rely on your expertise in terms of the research and what you can do in different parts of the world. But also from our perspective, we have to be comfortable about jurisdictional issues, mm-hmm. Whether we can write insurance for non-UK exposures. And with that brings a level of diligence that you have to do in terms of the likes of, we have to do sanctions checks these days, and make sure that before we incept on any policy, that we have the clear sanctions checks and the likes thereof.
Mm-hmm. So is there anything that can't be insured? Are there any, is there a possibility that a beneficiary that we can't find then can't also be insured by you?
Yeah, I mean, what you're looking at there really, as I say, as an underwriter, if you're looking at these sorts of risks, the two things you're looking at, or you ought to be looking at to come to a conclusion about the risk and its acceptability, is the remoteness of the risk, which we touched upon mm-hmm. earlier. How likely is it that this is going to happen? And that's where all the research and the family testimony will give you an insight. The other thing you're looking at then, in terms of whether you then want to go on offer cover, is the probable loss in the event of a claim. So you're looking at how likely is it that you're going to get a claim? And secondly, you're then looking at, if I do get a claim, what's it likely going to cost to put it right? So on a comfort case, for example, where you're not covering a comfort missing beneficiary case, for example, where you're not covering prior classes, you can probably work out where maybe somebody might come forward and how much they might be entitled to. On a known missing beneficiary case, you can usually work out quite easily what that person or those persons would be entitled to. So if in order to, you know, to get to the point where you're going to offer terms, you need to be comfortable about those two points. And I think to answer your question, are there any that you wouldn't offer cover on? It's going to be ones that fall foul of one or other of those.
Yeah.
And I give you two different, sort of, there are two different sides to that. You know, you could have a scenario where you think that the likelihood of a claim is pretty high, and you're starting off at a point where not too sure about this from a risk perspective. But you could then do the maths and work out that actually the probable likely loss in the event of a claim is extremely low.
Mm.
So those are all the things we do. And then if you've got a low probable loss on it, and you can charge a sufficiently high premium to make it worthwhile doing,
mm-hmm.
then you might be able to do it. And those are the sorts of things. But to answer your question, if you get one where you think, look, it's extremely likely, or indeed it's more than likely that you'll get a claim on this, and it's going to be very expensive to put right, those are the sorts of cases that, you know, you're going to get pushed back from.
Yeah.
And underwriters are going to say, look, probably not one we can do. Now, what an underwriter ought to be doing is then trying to come up with maybe solutions mm-hmm. for you to say, look, probably not one we can do at the moment, but hey ho, what we might be able to do is, if the solicitor or the advisor puts the money on deposit for 12 months or 24 months and then comes back, and maybe a further round of research is done, if that were to add anything to it, then maybe we could consider it again at that point.
Okay. I was going to say, actually, linked to that in the things, unusual situations, I guess, because we've had a little spate of inquiries that we discussed earlier on in the year where a solicitor has a beneficiary, there might be a fairly large sum of money at stake, but the beneficiary is declining the inheritance. So the challenge for the solicitor being that they might have a large sum of money that's set on their client account is too big to pay into court. Equally, they can't distribute it to a beneficiary, and we were talking about whether there was a solution to that, insurance or otherwise.
And they're really tricky cases, aren't they? Because depending on the scenario, that what we sometimes see is where they are in contact with the person, they've been located, either yourselves, you found them, however it may be, they've actually found the person, and there is an element of initial communication between the two parties. But at some point, it's very clear that the beneficiary doesn't want that money. They'll engage to that extent, but they won't engage to the point of entering into a sort of deed of renunciation or anything like that.
Yeah.
So you then got a really tricky position for the solicitor and the PR. Now, we do see these, as you say, and they are quite tricky to insure, actually, because you're effectively insuring something that really is at the whim of the beneficiary, because if that beneficiary chooses at any point, if they haven't renounced, and they choose at any point to come forward and say, actually, I'll have my money, and we all know people's circumstances change, so should they need the money in 6 months' time or 12 months' time, they might change their view and come back and come back calling and asking for that money. And as an insurer, you'd effectively have to put that gig. And as an insurer, you'd effectively have to pay them their money. So they're really tricky. I mean, we do see them, and we're happy to look at them, because I think each one turns on its own facts, really, depending on the sort of passage of time, the communication that's been entered into between the two parties. Sometimes we see beneficiaries who have made it absolutely clear they don't want it and they have no intention, and they will sign letters to that extent. They may not want to enter into a formal deed of renunciation or anything, but they'll make it abundantly clear that they don't want it, and things like that might give us enough to go on, rather than, you know, the other side of that scenario is just sort of verbal communication where they've just said, go away, leave me alone, I'm not interested in that person's estate or something like that. And that's really tricky, because if they change their mind in 6 months' time and you've written that business, you're probably just going to be paying out their entitlement, because at the end of the day, they are entitled, so the right thing to do would be to pay them their monies. But yeah, happy to look at them. Tricky for all parties involved, and I think they just turn on the facts of the case, really.
Okay, thank you.
I mean, one of the challenges we find that our clients come to us with is the old one where you have a small estate. Class of kin is quite remote, and it's known to be a large number of people or a large amount of research that's required. What solutions would you be able to assist with there to maximise really the estate that's available for the beneficiaries, rather than spending all of it on research or all of it on insurance? Is there anything you can do to work with us and the solicitor to do that?
Yeah, again, it's a tricky one, isn't it, that we do see. We've seen over the years, haven't we, and it does keep coming up. And there are things we can do. You're quite right. I think all of these cases, what needs to happen really is the solicitor, yourselves, and we need to engage and look at what the situation is. Now, it's very difficult to sort of... the ideal scenario is an insurance policy that can be put in place with, shall we say, limited cost spent on the research side of it, so that you're not exhausting the estate and there is some money left over to distribute to the beneficiaries. And I guess that's where everyone's working towards.
Yeah.
Now, we can work towards that, and we can have that conversation with you and this solicitor to try and get to that. The tricky bit is deciding what's the reasonable amount of research and the reasonable amount of cost to throw at it. So again, it comes back to really looking at the facts of the case. If we can get comfortable that, as you say, it's a relatively small amount, we can understand how many lines there are taking and how much each beneficiary is taking. Then we can try and understand our exposure about, or our likely exposure in terms of any incomplete lines or new beneficiaries coming forward. So what we might ask you to do in that scenario is to do a sort of fairly sort of light touch research exercise to sort of establish, maybe if we were in the class of an intestacy of uncles and aunts and their issue, we might ask you to at least try and see if you could establish how many there were on the paternal side and the maternal side, so that we can then take it from there between us, work out what is known, what's possibly missing, and then see if we can come up with a solution that again works for us but also works for the client, in terms of, because in that scenario you are reducing the cost of the research and maybe the inquiries, but you're bringing into the equation an insurance premium. So we have to come up with a premium that then works and still leaves enough money in the estate.
Yeah, and that's I think what we're trying to get to on those ones, is that it's always the biggest families that have the smallest estates, of course. And it's trying to find a solution that works for the beneficiaries as much as anybody else, but still protecting the PRs. I think that's what we're trying to get to on those ones.
It's one of the few reasons we would ask about the value of the estate as well, isn't it? So that we can actually consider insurance at the back end.
And I think that's important, is that we are keen to know how much an estate is worth when we first talk to a solicitor about intestacy, so that when we come to look for insurance with you, we know that it's £500,000. We have to make sure that everything is completely belt and braces, there aren't any missing documents or anything. Whereas if it's perhaps only £20,000, we want to be having a conversation very early on as to, do we actually want to spend a lot of money on research, or is there a better approach for our clients and the personal representatives, and talk to you a little bit earlier about how much we may or may not need to do. So that's absolutely right, Anthony, that we don't want to know the value of the estate to make more money out of it. In fact, it's quite the opposite. We want to come up with the best solution for the estate, not necessarily the best solution for research.
Yeah, and it's the same from an insurance angle as well, really, because you know, it's interesting the amount of times we have conversations with people where they will ask whether we can offer cover in respect of a particular risk, and one of the first questions we will ask, as you've just mentioned, is the size of the estate or the potential entitlement, because obviously that's what we're pricing what the exposure is. And it's always surprises me how you can have these long conversations with people and then you turn around and you ask them that fairly basic point, which is, what's the estate worth, or what's the potential exposure of this missing beneficiary, and they don't know. Now, that's absolutely fine, because that's, you know, they've got a lot of things to be thinking about in terms of distribution of the estate, but for us it's key, because that is the exposure. So for us, we're always asking that. We're always asking you to get that information for us, if it's the case that you're referring for insurance, precisely for that reason.
Is there a maximum insurance limit that you've got, or can we go as far as we want?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, we all have our maximum limits, and you know, they vary from time to time depending on the state of the market and insurer's risk appetite. But if I were to say, I've not had a query yet that has been too big in terms of value. So
that's good to know.
Yeah, absolutely. And likewise, the other side, too small as well. You know, we're not averse to considering small cases. If it's a particular problem, we see lots of inquiries from solicitors who have small amounts sitting on client account, historical amounts, under increasing pressure not to just sit on it anymore, to be doing something and be seen to be doing something. They can sometimes be for very small amounts. We can look at those as well and try and come up with solutions. The premium may be a significant part of that small amount that's sitting on client account, but it resolves the problem for them.
Yeah. So that's all we have time for today. To our audience, we really hope you found it useful. We'll also, obviously, if there are any inquiries from our listeners, direct them through to Title Research. And as for that, thank you again for joining us. And that's all we have time for. So thank you very much.
Thank you.